You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now, coming back to address lots of feedback that we received about a month or so ago when he was on, is Lee Matamua Taituha. Kia ora, Lee. How are you?
Kia ora, Marie. Kia ora, New Zealand.
We had you on about a month or so ago. We got a ton of feedback. Everybody was like, you blew our minds in terms of the economics and your vision of it. And we got some feedback. And I'm going to read out the main one. I read it out after we got it, but I'm going to read it again for everybody. And we're going to dive in because what I love is the fact that you are more than happy to address the feedback and you want to go through your insights from the feedback and how you see it. And I just think that that's wonderful because it just shows that, you know, to use a financial balance, you put your money where your mouth is. The biggest piece of feedback that came back was from Rob. And Rob said, hi, Marie. Farzan Irani would correct your guess. He is wrong about New Zealand not loaning billions for COVID, etc. He mentions we did borrow from China, which he says we didn't. And he is correct. But that assumption is that money was created and is sort of correct but misleading. Now, we're going to go through all of these points as we go along. New Zealand Reserve Bank is a private organisation that has shares in the world's central banks and that have shares in the Bank of International Settlements where everything gets repaid digitally, balance sheet or not, in US dollars. These central banks loan out billions of dollars to enable COVID injections to be purchased, create debt, and the debt is extracted from us, the public, through our local councils and rates. The lending of billions is secured through our properties, through all banks where the debt exists, meaning anyone in debt in a bank in a serious jeopardy of a default when all banks collapse, and at the same time as the impending financial collapse coming is going to show. I do not leave money in any New Zealand bank, as we, like Israel, are the only countries that do not have a deposit insurance scheme which guarantees a certain amount the bank has of your actually now their money if they default on paying out to you. There is no guarantee your money is not safe. He sort of gives us the information, but he's completely wrong about debt is not incurred. The main problem is debt, real or not, is an electronic transaction, is still a transaction. Once there's a breakdown, all will stop. A Reserve Bank may be adopt government information, but it operates outside of government. And does the Prime Minister and Cabinet Office, they have no beholding to anyone, which is why Ardern got away with her captain's call over COVID lockdowns and mandates. Market rates aside, our expansion solves money issues. The Treasury may not run into overdraft, but the debt is debt. This is crazy saying otherwise. But the main issue is debt is not always paid back in money. The price you pay may be your freedom. There's a lot to unpack there, and the nice thing is that we flick that to you. So just to let anybody know that when you do send your feedback in and you've got specific feedback for guests, we do pass that feedback on. So you've had that feedback, Lee, and you've actually had some time to digest it. So where would you like to start?
Well, thank you, Rob. You're precisely right, Marie. If you have anybody out there has any questions, pull them through. That's the key. It's the discussion. I represent something that's counterintuitive to most, so I'm grateful that Rob took the time to do that, and I'm hoping he's listening. Also, everybody else, so know my haramai, keep the questions coming in. We've got to discuss these things. But here I am going, now, it's like a mosquito flying over a nudist colony. It's like I don't know where to start with all that. So the key here that I can give is that since we spoke last, so in the last 6 or 7 weeks, I've launched my website, PātakaInstitute.com, and we've had 100,000 views of my economic insights and materials on there, and subscribers who've come on. What I can say to Rob and the listeners as well is that that's pretty much indicative of the types of questions I get. What's in common with them all, and I'll refer to Rob's question, he's talking about debt, he's talking about the role of the Reserve Bank, what is it, and why do we keep getting it wrong? You know, we're facing an underperforming economy. The short answer to this is I invite Rob and the listeners to consider the statement, the sequence. It's a sequence of events that occurs in monetary operations. The key point, though, is that the Reserve Bank is the government's record keeper. It's like the electronic scorekeeper. at a, say, a rugby game or a rugby test, you've got the electronic scorekeeper up there keeping track of the score, but the scoreboard can never run out of dollars, or meaning the scoreboard can't run out of numbers. So the role of the Reserve Bank is the record keeper. It's the electronic scorekeeper for the government. Now, the independent aspect of the Reserve Bank is its ability to be able to set interest rates up and down. And that's what I'd like to get to today in response to Rob about the real issue of price stability. How do we get the price of eggs down, groceries down? How do we get the prices down? How do we stabilize prices? The key thing here is interest rates. But before we get there, the role of the Reserve Bank, this mandate was established back in the mid-80s when Don Brash was the first Reserve Bank governor that took over at the time of what's called inflation targeting. So his role was clear. You keep inflation between 0 and 3% or we sack you. That's basically what the mandate is. And that was set up under the Labor government with Roger Douglas. So,
buddy, that isn't the case these days, but I digress.
Yeah, so the point was there, and this is where I think the average punter out there, and including Rob, gets the sequence incorrect, because what Rob has stated there is actually precisely correct if we were still on a fixed currency, on a fixed exchange rate, which meant the New Zealand dollar is tied to something else. Mm-hmm. Those insights around the government getting into debt and running out of dollars, and then the government needs to run itself like us, like a household or a business, that's all precisely correct, but it's under a former regime, under a previous regime. That all changed in the mid-80s. My answer to Rob is that, and I'm trying to unpack that discussion here, because I think there's some political drivers in this discussion too, in this question. So it's not, I'm here to address the actual technical monetary operations, not what I'd like them to be or what I'd like monetary policy to be, but what it actually is. And I think what Rob is saying is that what he'd like it to be. So the role of the Reserve Bank is the electronic scorekeeper of the government. Treasury sends an email and sends instructions to the Reserve Bank to credit accounts up and debit accounts down on behalf of the government. So the Reserve Bank's role is just to clear the payments. So every New Zealander and every other country, including our trade partners, everybody who has New Zealand dollars in an account is on a spreadsheet in Wellington. So whether there's New Zealand dollars tied up around the world, it's all on a spreadsheet in Wellington. And the electronic spreadsheet, like the electronic scoreboard at a rugby game, that electronic spreadsheet cannot run out of dollars. It can't run out of money. It can't run out of digits. It's like getting to the end of a rugby test and the referee goes, full time, 10 minutes before the end, and everyone's going, hey, well, what are you stopping the game for? And the referee says this, oh, because the scoreboard's going to run out of digits. So it can't. It's just literally an electronic scorekeeper. That's its role.
So then is this how Robbo managed to conjure up all the money he managed to conjure up for the COVID crisis?
Right. And then we can move into that other part. So I'm just still, I want to clarify the sequence and the role of the Reserve Bank. It's there as it literally sits on a spreadsheet. It receives instructions from the government and us, because our bank accounts, regardless of whose bank if you're Kiwi Bank, Westpac, ANZ, whoever, every regulated bank in New Zealand has bank accounts at the Reserve Bank. The Reserve Bank is the supervisor and the regulator of all of our banks. And on one spreadsheet is all of our accounts. Okay, so all of the banks report back to they supervise there. So that's the role of the Reserve Bank. It's the mothership, if you like, including the government. But the government, through legislation, democratically, of course, everything about the Reserve Bank is run from the government. It's set up under the Reserve Bank Act, which is an act of Parliament, and the Public Finance Act. It operates within rules. The point I'm making about this is why we get it so wrong, and not just Rob, but everybody. Even I did. I mean, I studied mainstream economics from high school right through university, and I didn't know either, because very few economists actually have ever operated a spreadsheet inside a bank. Very few economists actually know anything about money. We just assume, we got these economists that appear on the news and they know all about that. They've got no clue. I would challenge you to ask any former Reserve Bank governor if he actually understood how the accounts cleared and debited in his own bank. The insights that I'm sharing with you here today have come from co-authors of mine and co-researchers of mine who actually owned banks, who saw how the accounts clear on the ground. That was their living, not a concept or a theory that they had. Robbers would be right, and those concerns would be right. And if you look at the government now and former governments, they will all say, oh, look, we have to tighten our belts because we can't spend too much because that could cause inflation. And, you know, we could end up with Zimbabwe, Venezuela, and all these horror stories. That would be true if New Zealand, including the rest of the world, were not operating what are called floating exchange rates, which is what we have now. So the key point here is understanding the mechanics and then understanding the role of the Reserve Bank, that prior to the mid-80s, 1985, prior to that point, the world was where most of the countries around the world had fixed currencies. And prior to 1971, before the US came off the gold standard, everybody was on a gold standard. So for decades and decades and decades, we got used to driving what I would call a manual car with a gear stick and a clutch, right? Then in 1985, we sold that manual car and we bought an automatic transmission. But since the mid-80s, we still think we need a clutch and a gear stick. It's the operations that changed, but our mentality and policy, therefore, did not change accordingly with it. I'm trying to summarize Rob's question because it's loaded, there's a lot in there. But then also to Rob and everybody listening, I'll stop at that point there to turn over to you. Mm-hmm. But ask again after I've just said what I've said, send some more questions in there. So yeah. What we have to understand is the setup first. The legislation was built for a floating currency, but our policies and our understanding is still left back in the fixed currency days. And that's my role here, is to facilitate a discussion to ask the questions about the operations, not policy. I don't care which way we go on policy, we'll leave that to the democratic process. I'm just saying, do you know how the operations works? And I challenged any former Reserve Bank governor to come on the show and show me where I'm wrong.
Just looking at what Rob had to say, one of the things that I wanted to pull out was around, he mentioned, do not leave any money in New Zealand banks, as we, like in Israel, are the only countries that do not have deposit insurance scheme, which guarantees a certain amount in the bank has of your, actually now their money, and if they default on paying it back to you. So essentially he's heralding a concern. If
yes.
The spreadsheet that you're talking about in Wellington, at any time the Reserve Bank could go in and actually dip into your deposits and actually take your money. So talk me through that.
Yeah, that's right. So, look, I can understand why Rob would have that concern and everybody listening would have that concern because, again, we're used to what I call fixed currency mentality. We're used to the government being like us, like a household or a business, you know, where it has to have an income. Like all of us are regular human beings here. We need to have an income and balance that against our outgoings. All right. That's life. But that's not correct. If you are an operator of a currency that's a floating currency. In answer to that, the government doesn't have, nor the government doesn't not have, dollars. It is literally spreadsheet. So if the fear is, well, they could go in there, grab all my money, right? Or they could go to China and hock us off to the Chinese and borrow money from the Chinese so we can build hospitals and roads. None of that's true. The government, through its agents, the banks, has no what I call solvency issues. It can't run out of dollars. So the government can't go broke even if it tried. The major fear is because we don't understand the correct sequence. We have this fear of solvency, going bankrupt. We're going to run out of dollars and then we owe China all these dollars. So I'll talk about what government debt actually is on a floating currency system. So this does not count for the previous fixed currency system, but we're on a floating system now. On a floating system, government debt is simply all of the dollars that government has spent into the economy through its agents, the bank, starting with the Reserve Bank. You know, so when you get your pension every fortnight, that arrives as digits in your bank account. It's just typing digits up and typing digits down. So this system is not something I'm inventing or what I'd like. This is actually how it happens now. The term government debt itself, that term is an anachronism. It's an old term that doesn't apply today. So a government debt used to be where the government would have to, in air quote marks, take money from us, right, through the sale of bonds so it could afford to spend. That was true on a fixed currency. That's why we had what we call bond sales when we're on a gold standard, because the government had to sell bonds in order to raise the dollars, because it's gold that it had was tied to dollars. That no longer applies. Government debt is simply this, and I'll make it quite simple in one sentence. Government debt is all of the dollars that the government has spent into the economy through its agents, the banks, that have not yet been used to pay taxes. That's what government debt is. It's all the dollars that are out in the economy that haven't been paid back to the government in taxes. Simply put, government debt is our savings, right down to the last cent. So on the spreadsheet, the government spends out into the economy and projects and spending, government spending. Back in the day on a gold standard, that would be called debt, but it's not now. But we still use the name. Why? Because it's politically convenient for political parties to blame the previous government for putting us into debt. It's a political pawn. And the ACT Party are at the moment the ones leading that discussion. We have all this debt. Like, for instance, when they campaigned back in the previous election, the ACT Party would say, well, we're $60 billion in debt. We've got to bring that debt down. So that $60 billion is this, for instance, in debt. It's $60 billion that the government has spent into the economy that we haven't paid back yet in taxes.
So then what happens when you've put all that money in the economy and you've invested it poorly?
Right.
So you don't get a return back in taxes.
Right. So that's right. We'll move into that now around policy decision making. But what I want to make clear to our listeners across the country, I'm hoping now that you're clear on the role of the Reserve Bank, but also the sequence here and what the operations actually is. And now we're going to get to how do you do that? How would you do that without creating inflation? Because that's the key here, price stability. If we had a stabilization of prices across New Zealand right now, this government would be sure to win next election. But I doubt that they even know what I'm talking about. So I would guess that by the time we get to the next election, the opposition would have a lot of fodder on this government, because I know this government doesn't understand what I'm saying. There's no way that they can stabilize prices with the current thinking, what I call the fixed currency mentality, the fixed operations mentality. All they can do is jig around the edges. But what's required is a complete rethink, which has got to come from the people, our listeners hearing right now. It's not going to come from the politicians. It's going to come from you, and you're going to tell the politicians. So they'll campaign on this new understanding. My warning is this: if we don't get this right, if New Zealanders don't even have this debate with me or even want to enter into the discussion because it sounds too weird, no way is this going to stabilise our economy. Whether you're on the left or the right, the pendulum swing between Labour and National, ding-dong, backwards and forwards, none of that's going to change until you stop and understand this. Let's move on to, okay, Lee, if the government doesn't face any solvency issues, then the fear is this, which I always get in these questions. We accept we're on a floating exchange rate, right, but if we leave it to these Muppets in Parliament, they're just going to helicopter money everywhere and spray it around the country, and we're going to end up like Zimbabwe and the Weimar Republic and Venezuela. And they'd be exactly correct if there were idiots running it. And I think that's the position I'm trying to make, is that there is a way that the government can spend that not only stabilizes prices, but it protects against inflation, but they don't know it. So that the first thing is, if the government were to spend and create new dollars through its agents, the banks, and each of those dollars was tied to the creation of a new good or service, that's the key here. If a dollar is spent on the creation of a new good or service that's in demand, that someone wants to purchase with those dollars, that's non-inflationary. I'll give you an example. After World War II, so Japan got wiped out in World War II. It had to start from scratch again. And what it did was it set up monetary policy after World War II that said basically that they were allowed to retain a currency, so they were going to create dollars to build a new economy. And they only allowed the banks to produce dollars for the creation of new goods and services. That means that the economy can grow and it stabilizes prices. It's like filling the sink with a tap. If you fill the tap, let the tap open, you fill the sink up with water, but the water is able to drain out through the creation of new goods and services, it doesn't overflow.
Okay, so then is this how the Chinese managed to fund their Belt and Road Initiative?
So the Chinese, like us and all these other countries around the world, operate floating exchange rates, which basically they create the dollars. So they are the source of the dollars. It's actually illegal. It would be counterfeit if China produced New Zealand dollars. And like us, we're not allowed to produce Chinese dollars. And you and I, we're not allowed to go down in the basement of our house and start printing out New Zealand dollars. That's counterfeit. Okay, so each state operates its own currency. And so the key here, though, just I want to settle the listener's mind, is that our major concern is always inflation. It's not even unemployment, really, but I'll get to unemployment in a minute. People care more about the price they pay at the grocery store than whether their neighbor's got a job or not. That's what hits us every day. Buying a bottle of milk, buying the eggs, paying the power bill, the rent, the mortgage, all that sort of stuff. Price stability is the key argument behind what I'm saying here, and I'm showing you exactly why we don't achieve that. We're driving an automatic car, but with a manual mentality. The idea around price stability is to understand that every dollar going out into the economy, if it's tied to the creation of new goods and services, you don't get inflation. In fact, you can have the counter. You can get deflation, where prices can actually come down dramatically and spiral down. The idea of price stability is to know where the dollars are coming from. Okay, so they're being spent out of the economy to create new things, but the government doesn't face a solvency issue in being able to do that. What my policy is saying here, what my program is putting forward, is that now that you know that you can't run out of the dollars, how you spend them is the key thing. There's no solvency issue. That's off the table. For most of New Zealand out there and world out there, we're still struggling to get over that issue. You know, that's what we think we pay taxes for, because we're paying our part so the government can build things. That's false too. Price stability is achieved through the creation of new goods and services. Every time a dollar is spent to create new goods and services, that dollar is non-inflationary. And also on top of that, our living standards go up. How you measure the raising of a living standard is the creation of new goods and services. That's how we go from a horse and cart to an automatic car transmission, right? Hopefully I've answered that question. This inflation issue, we operate a floating currency. Solvency is not an issue. The real question is this, New Zealand. Inflation, price stability. That's the key, not solvency. Getting a steady growing economy is the creation of new goods and services. And the more people you have unemployed, the less you're able to do that. So full employment is not just about, you know, everyone having a job, but there's such a thing as underemployment. We could be producing boondoggle industries that no one wants to even get involved in. But I'll tell you why house prices go up. Like, there's a good example of getting it wrong. Here's how you get it wrong. You give someone a loan to go to an auction. They take the $1 million to the auction. Then they bid up the house price. But you know there was no new good or service produced. There was just a real estate agent and an established house. No new house was produced out of that. That's the key. However, if that $1 million was produced to produce new houses, now you get price stability because now you've got more in the marketplace. Banks loaning, giving you a mortgage just because you've got money already or a current asset, then you go to an auction, you don't build a new house. That's how we got the mess around inflation. So you have to regulate these banks. And this is my proposal here, how you do that. No more lending on already established assets. No more lending on financial assets. No more lending only lending for the creation of new goods and services. Okay, so create loans for chippies and plumbers and tradies to build new houses, not new loans for people to go and buy another house based on the house they already own.
Okay, so there's a couple of things I want to unpick here. Okay. I had a conversation, beginning of this year, with Doug Casey, who is a very well-known international finance guy. And he talked very much the difference between, similar to what you've just said, between investment and speculation.
Yeah.
So he said going to buy an existing house is actually it's not an investment, it's speculation, whereas creating something new is investment. So that I've got my head around.
It'll How do we get the good stuff? he's exactly right. He's exactly right. Is that the investment and speculation, that's key here. That's a key thing to understand. If the government is in the business of investing in New Zealanders to create new goods and services, you get a stable economy. Not only that, too, you get living standards going up.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what happens, the perverted side of this whole thing is that there's no limit on fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is government spending, right, and taxation. Monetary policy is where we get it wrong. Monetary policy doesn't work, and it's backwards, and it buggers up fiscal policy. So the direct relationship between the government and those people who put people in there is interfered with these bureaucrats in the middle who think they know about what we're talking about here. But I ask you to challenge any of the former Reserve Bank governors and ask them, how do their actual accounts debit and credit, mate? Because they're not involved in this. These are political appointees who put on these policies. Like, I'll give you an example. When there is, let's move into interest rates, and it's the interest rate that buggers this whole thing up. Okay, so but New Zealanders also too must move on from the issue of solvency. I'm hoping I'm moving us from that. Let's move on from the solvency issue. I'm hoping we've answered that. On a floating currency, the government is not fixed in its currency to anything else, so it sets the value of the dollar when it's spending. When it spends, the New Zealand dollar is the only thing that we can use to pay our taxes with. The fact that we have to pay taxes in New Zealand dollars means it's valuable to us. Now, most of us would think, yeah, but I don't just earn money to go and pay taxes. I want to buy groceries and a car and a lifestyle. Those things are discretionary, but a tax liability is mandatory. It's what drives the value of the dollar. The fact that it's the only thing that we can use. We can't turn up to the Reserve Bank and offer cabbages for taxes. It has to be New Zealand dollars, and not Bitcoin either. That's the perverted thing about these cryptocurrencies. None of them can be used to pay taxes. So they're actually worthless. It's like just a musical chairs that's going on between those, unless you convert your Bitcoin into New Zealand dollars. It's the New Zealand dollar that's issued by the government through its agents, the banks. That's the only thing that we can use to pay the taxes. So that's what causes us to be involved in the economy. We are creators of goods and services seeking the government's dollars in payment of our goods and services that we use to pay the government liability, the tax liability. So once we move here now, I want to get into the driver, the fly in the ointment of this whole thing, which is the role of the Reserve Bank and the setting of interest rates, because they think they're getting it right, but they never do. So this interest rate thing, for the listeners, this is the simplest way I can describe interest. It's a parasite. So interest does not add value to the economy. It extracts value. So people that aren't involved in the actual production of the goods and services are there earning commission, or they're earning in between, but they're not actually the one producing the goods and services. So interest does not add value, it extracts value. Now, the mentality again, which comes from the fixed currency days, is this. Everybody will be listening, and it's a fait accompli. All these splash economists and working for these banks and the universities, professors and so forth, and New Zealanders will think right now, if prices start going up, like we get inflation, okay, that's the real scare. We think, oh, well, Reserve Bank's going to have to raise interest rates. It's just a fait accompli, isn't it? We don't even think about it. And also, too, how they raise the rates is there's no numeria or there's no calculation that's made. These people sit in a committee and just raise their hands. What do you reckon, there, Don? Should we raise it up 0.5? What are you, 0.25? And they vote on these interest rates. There's no calculus. It's just a fait accompli. And then they base that interest rate setting on what I would call archaic data that does not apply today. So they look at what's called the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, that is not a measure of inflation. The Consumer Price Index is a measure of yesterday's prices. It's like looking into the rear vision mirror.
Mm.
Okay, so they go, oh, well, look, prices have been going up this last month. Well, we better raise interest rates and try and bring them down again. That's completely backwards. So the CPI is not a measure of inflation. It's a measure of the cost of living. And those are two different things. So inflation is a constant increase in the price level faced by us today, but for prices in the future. That's inflation, not the price yesterday. So what the Reserve Bank is actually doing every time, and not only our Reserve Bank, other central banks around the world do this all the time. They look at yesterday's prices and then they navel gaze. They sit back in their chair, look up at the ceiling and go, oh, what do you reckon, guys? And they just guess. This is where they get it wrong all the time because they don't understand this. Ask any former Reserve Bank governor this question. Governor, when you raise the interest rate, right, you're squeezing the productive economy, right? And that's what they're trying to do. So they're making it more expensive for us to go to the bank and get a loan, so we don't. So the idea is to reduce the money supply into the economy, what it's called reducing aggregate demand, so reducing economic activity. So that's why we do it. So people think, well, the way to put the inflation fire out is to raise interest rates up, and then that the idea is people have less money to spend, and so it brings prices down. So what you're doing on one side is that you are squeezing the productive economy. So now that tradie that's trying to finish that house got to go back to the bank, and now it's a higher interest rate. Now he's got to sack his apprentice. And now that house doesn't get finished. So you're squeezing that economy, the productive part of the economy, the aggregate demand. But this is what's happening that none of them can answer. And ask any Reserve Bank governor. When you raise the interest rate, governor, what happens to the yield on Treasury securities? They'll probably answer, well, I don't know. Or they might say, oh, the yield goes down. No, it does not. And this is the key. They think that they're squeezing aggregate demand by raising interest rates. They think they're disciplining the economy, right? Trying to get prices down. But at the same time, when they raise the interest rate, they are raising the earnings on government bonds, which are called Treasury securities. So if you're rich enough to own a government bond, a treasury security, now you've got paid for having money. We think we're shutting down, turning the tap off, the money tap, but what's actually happening is at the back of the house, the shower's been turned on full blast, and we're leaking water out the back of the house, thinking the front of the house is going to stay dry. We've got this system of government bond sales. That system there is actually new dollars. So we think we're reducing dollars into the economy. No, we're not. If you own a government bond and you just earn interest on it, because that's why you have them for, you purchase government bonds to earn interest. It's a savings account. Earning interest is like your own savings account. When you earn that saving, that's real dollars available for you to use that as security on a loan and go out into the economy and speculate on housing prices, on housing, you know, you see what I'm saying? So there's a second side of the coin that most New Zealanders have got no clue about. And when I bring this up and you'll see this on my website, patakainstitute.com, P-A-T-A-K-A, institute.com. Little plug there. You'll see that people have no idea even what a government bond is. They think it's some flashy banky thing over there that they're not involved in. It doesn't affect their life. It affects your life right now. If you go to the dairy to buy eggs, just know that that price rise in your eggs or your milk is affected by interest earned on government bonds. This idea, which I didn't believe in before I met my fellow authors who actually own banks and operated banks, I never believed this tale of the rich and the poor. I thought it was just hyperbole and it doesn't matter. It is true. What happens is that the productive part of the economy gets squeezed, whereas those who have all these savings that are tied up in government bonds are paid what I call a universal basic income for just having money. This monetary policy thing, it actually creates a social divide.
So then is that by accident or on purpose?
No, look, a friend of mine wrote a book called The Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds, my mate Warren. And no, look, if we're sitting here in a discussion here with all the previous Reserve Bank governors and Roger Douglas, who might be listening out there, I don't believe that they had bad intentions at heart. I don't believe they're terrible people, not at all. I mean, I know Don Brash, he's a gentleman, but they just don't understand the operations. So I don't think they set up to do it. But what happens when you set your politics around up not knowing this, where you say, okay, we've got a floating currency now in mid-80s, but we're going to treat it like it's fixed. That's basically what they did, because they thought, because they, like any other human being, they think, well, I work for the government, and that means I'm like a house or a business, and I've got a, but no, what house or business do you know operates its own currency? I'm diplomatic and saying, I don't believe these were terrible people. I don't know Adrian Orr. I don't think he's a terrible person. I just think he doesn't know how operations works. It's as simple as that. Mm. When the government wants to raise money for COVID, for instance, the $60 billion, yeah, we think we go to, over to China to borrow money off them. That is not what happens. We think we're selling these government bonds, and so we're hocked up to the Chinese so we can buy vaccines or pay for COVID subsidies. That's not true at all. That's not what happens. If the government wanted to create dollars, it can just do it, just type it into the accounts. The idea of even having bond sales, having to sell bonds to raise dollars, is not even necessary. It was necessary when we operated a fixed currency. The government had no choice but to sell bonds. But we've kept that archaic system from a manual transmission in an automatic era. So what I'm saying is that government bonds aren't even, the whole process of even selling bonds is not even necessary.
So then I just want to sort of bring it back to people every day. If we can't change government's economic habits for the right now, how do we then change our own economic habits to make things a little bit easier for ourselves?
The first thing is to learn this. Learn what we've talked about today. Don't just give up and say, oh, well, look, that's for the flash economists, and then tune out of culture counterculture today. Don't do that. Engage in this discussion and show me where I'm wrong. Because at the very least, it'll cause you to stop and think. Okay, the very best thing you could do is vote with an informed decision. We just vote for these things backwards and forwards, and we listen to these politicians all the time. Oh, like, for instance, we're in $60 billion worth of debt, right? So vote for me, I'll bring that debt down. Don't do that anymore. The government doesn't owe anybody anything. The government issues its own currency. This government debt term is irrelevant. So now the issue is, what do I do here today? There is absolutely nothing you can do. Nothing that you can do other than educate yourself and understand this. You are not the Reserve Bank governor, and you can't just go in there tomorrow and say 0% interest for the next 10 years, because that would solve it. There'd be no more interest paid on government bonds. You don't get mega rich people speculating on house prices. And then if there's no more interest, then the tradie can go and get an interest-free loan and finish those houses he's been building to drop the house prices. So New Zealanders, and that's what I think what happens with us is, quite simply, we wait right until the end till we can't do anything. And that's the key here. The best thing you can do is to educate yourself on these things. And now the point too is that, what do you have to lose than but to learn something new? And also too, I'm open to say, well, just show me where I'm wrong and I'll shut up. The key around your daily practices is pay more attention now. You know how it hurts when you got your power bill's up, prices are up, it hurts, eh? I'm saying that we can end that. It can turn around if you understand. A majority of the country were to understand this, we could switch it around immediately. A simple solution is this. Government limits the creation of new dollars for the creation of new goods and services only. So it regulates the banks to do that only. Banks always lend to housing because the old adage is it's safe as houses. Banks know that if you don't pay, they own the house. And it terrifies people. The thought of losing your house is what, that's why banks focus on those marketplaces around, say, for housing, for instance. The key that you can understand that for the listener is to, if you're really sick of it, you would stop and listen. But I don't think most are. And that's what happens. We tend to, you know, unless it's right in front of our face. And then what's worse, Marie, is we get used to it.
Before the global financial crisis, and there was that period of time in between, and I remember this, you know, as a young adult and a teen, you probably do too, is there were a lot of investment funds and venture capital type businesses who loaned to businesses and entrepreneurs for productive services. So you could go in and pitch your idea to them for capital to create something new.
Yes.
And you see that in the United States more. In this country, it appears to have all but evaporated into a puff of smoke. Well, why is that? Yeah.
I'll give it something. So I use the Japanese example when they just it's what I call you made the difference between investment and speculation. Yeah, we've got to go down the investment path, investing in people through employment to create new goods and services that stabilizes prices and raises living standards. That's the goal. We've had fragments of this in the past, including in New Zealand, when the currency was floated in the early 80s, and then we had the Think Big projects that was in the Muldoon government. But the Labour government had to come along and try and use the monetary system to counter that just to get elected. So the Labour government said, we can't keep just creating dollars like this and these Think Big projects because it's going to cause inflation and the government's going to run out of money, even though it's impossible to do that on a floating currency. So it was a political have, okay? Whereas New Zealanders would look back at that time and say, look, the 80s was the, you know, we had full employment, we had these big, the hydro dam projects with the whole lot of infrastructure being built, right? Very low inflation. And that because it was tied, the spending was tied to the creation of new goods and services, creating employment. But it was a political decision to try and get rid of that government where this myth of insolvency emerged. And so there's the pockets of even in New Zealand history where we got it right. Most countries in the world after World War II, especially Europe, they had to rebuild. So they went down the track. For instance, in Germany, for instance, there was about 1,500 small banks lending to SMEs, small businesses, at low interest rates, but only for the creation of new goods and services. And you had a stable economy for that point. Whereas now we've got these four or five big global banks around the world, right, that will only invest in speculation. So we've had changes in banking systems where people don't really know about it because it doesn't affect them every day. They just face it when they go up to the till or the pay wave at the shop. So the everyday person does not pay attention to this sort of stuff. And so my point to the listeners out there is the fact that you are not an economist, the fact that maybe what I'm saying over today is like what Rob has said is counterintuitive. It sounds all backwards and wrong. But don't default out of the discussion just because you're not an economist. I think that you have a tremendous advantage if you know nothing about this, because then you have nothing to unlearn. There are a lot of people out there with a lot to lose by me showing them that they're wrong. And that's the key here, is that if you truly want to, like we say, education is the key. You have to understand it. But if we truly want to make a change for our kids' future, we must be better informed. And then we must debate about it. If the Reserve Bank is right, that means I'm completely wrong. So get one of them on here to show me where I'm wrong. I'll say to them, no, when you raise interest rates, you're raising the yield on Treasury securities, and that increases aggregate demand. It doesn't reduce it. That's why you never seem to stabilize prices. You notice that? Nothing's ever worked since we've started playing around with the inflation targeting. But the downside of it that most New Zealanders don't see and they don't feel every day is that when you raise those interest rates, people are getting sacked. People are losing their jobs because these businesses can't afford to hire them anymore. The average punter, the average Kiwi out there, if they've got a job, they don't know the pain of not having a job. So they go to the shop and they go, oh, shit, gee, egg prices are up today. And that's their major concern. But they're not realizing the same system that caused those prices to go up is the same system that causes other people to lose their jobs. You let that go on for decades and generations, now you've got this cultural war between Māoris and Pākehās in New Zealand, because you've got these politicians in between making up this oppression story. It's not racism. It's economic incompetence. These brainy buggers for the last few decades didn't know that they were wrong, and they don't want to admit they're wrong. And now we're left with this culture divide. We're left with the rich and the poor. You get that in any economy, but now we've got these activists in between who use it as political capital.
Okay, so now that we've headed into this.
That's the name of the show, eh, mate?
Yeah, now that we've headed into this neck of the woods, we've just had Mātariki this past weekend. I want to get your thoughts on this, because when I grew up, Matariki was kind of like this turning point in the calendar, which meant that you needed to get your head in the game, because my grandfather would always used to say to me, got to get your head in the game because we're going to be planting the kumara soon. That was pretty much, it was like the celestial road sign in the calendar. And he was a big sort of believer of the Māori fishing calendar. Bill Hohepa was a huge fan of him. And he followed all those sort of roadmaps and markers. Now, all of a sudden, we have this public holiday. And I mean, I know everyone out there loves a public holiday and a day off. Yeah. But if you're an employer, which I have been for a long time, in various forms, another public holiday is another expense without productivity, which, you know, creates all sorts of issues in itself. Is this taking a cultural road sign within the Māori calendar and turning it into a way to placate the masses using culture?
We're airing here on Wednesday over the Matariki weekend on my education website, the Pātaka Institute website. I ran a Matariki special offer, and we had tons of, we had thousands of people get on and view some of our materials. I didn't stop working. Matariki's about work. This is the time you harvest. This is the time what you know. So, but our response is that anything that's cool, oh, it's just create a holiday. Well, no, that message is completely counter to the message of Matariki. It's the time when you're supposed to be the busiest. It's the time when you're supposed to be preparing. So basically there, it's the opposite to a holiday. However, also on my website, what I want to do is put Matariki into context, and I'll help you do this, is to the listeners. I'm all for the celebration of it. And like I said, I celebrated Matariki by offering a special offer to students. But however, I want to put it into context. On my website too, you'll see, and we have our closing karakia at the end of our broadcast today, Marie, I use the term pai marire, right? And that's the core of my faith. And it's based upon a man, my prophet, Kingi Tawhia, who established an understanding of the cosmos, and it's reflected inside the pai marire. So just to put Matariki in context, Matariki is a constellation of Pleiades. It's Messier 45. Pleiades, it's right in our solar, in our galaxy, the Milky Way. It's a local constellation. Pai Mariri, however, talks about the whole universe. So Matariki in context to Pai Mariri is this. If you looked at the end of your nose, that would be looking as far as Matariki. Then you would have to have a nose the length of our solar system to see right back to the start of the universe. So to put it in context, if you want to have a holiday about a local constellation, then we should have a holiday every day about the whole universe. What we've done here is that we've had these luminaries over the last 30 years come up with a story that's based on something that they know. But when I share my karakia at the end of our broadcast today, I'll show you the whole universe, not just the local constellation at the end of our nose here, just a local constellation. There's a much bigger picture. It's much more than Matariki. And it's much further than even the Milky Way. That's where the traditional knowledge that I'm sharing comes from. It comes from right back at the beginning. I'll give an example. Is that there's light traveling from the start of the universe that's 13.8 billion years old that's just arriving now through your window. Matariki is just a local constellation just next to you. And my karakia and pai marire, it teaches that. It goes right from the beginning, korangi ko papa, right at the beginning of the whole universe. Then if we come right to the end of the karakia, right up to the end, because it would take me about 20 minutes to recite the whole thing to you, what I share with you on air is just a very small trigger. It's a small snippet called the Orfortha. So what I'm saying is that I'll double down on Matariki. I say, okay, kapwai, good on you. Thank you for teaching me about this, and you got your holiday. I'll double down on that show about the whole picture. So this Māori knowledge is not limited to one constellation, but it's been sold like that, where we think it's an enormous achievement to talk about. And then we say, well, like you said, was it your dad? He said, oh, is this how we fish to this and plant the kumaras and all that? Well, now we've got the James Webb telescope that can show us the whole universe. Okay, if we're still sitting here wondering about when to plant the kumaras, we're still living 200 years ago. Whereas my karakia, Pai Marire, talks about the most up-to-date information that comes available to us now. So what I'm saying here, lovely. It's lovely. It suits a few luminaries, but I'll challenge anybody who wants to talk about Matariki to talk about the whole universe, not just that local constellation. And then it gets hijacked by government, you know, and then they, you know.
We're coming up on time now, Lee, so why don't you share that karakia with us and see us off for the rest of the morning.
Kawai. So Pai Mari starts with rire, is right up into outer space, past Matariki, way out to the beginning. And rire into space and rire below into the ocean. So rire above and rire below, we just don't know. And ho is the angle that brings those two coordinates together. Pai means good. Rire into the ma is the coordinate or the compass headings. And into rire, into the unknown. Pai marire is to know where you're going, right? Way out beyond Matariki and way back in too. So rire, rire ho, pai marire. Tō tiakina māra matanga e te atua. So that your guiding knowledge e te atua, and I refer to i o matua te kore, right at the beginning, again, way past Matariki, out at the beginning. Our listeners out there, whoever you would pray to, just so long as it's bigger than you, okay? So, i tō tiakina māra matanga e te atua. Ki tō mātou kingi, and I'm referring to my king, King Tuheitia, and also to King Charles III. Let's bring these cultures together. Let's get some economic policy correct. Let's fix up monetary policy to bring our country together because it's divided. And it's unnecessary because of our economic performance has driven this culture war. So that's inside this karakia. Ki ngā tinana I mauiwi ana. To our people out there who are, as a result of all this underperformance, are sick, physically sick, cold, can't afford the kai, can't afford to pay the rent, power bill. I ngā mauiwi ana. They're not only sick physically, but now and then emotionally. They're scared people out there who are scared at this cultural divide that's occurred. And I'm saying it all has a source. And I'm asking you, our people out there, to listen to these insights and that we can turn this around. Tainoa ki a mātou katoa. That means down to us here listening right now. We can do this. I ask us all to put our assumptions aside, put our ego aside, and to stop and think and listen and debate and discuss these things. If I'm wrong, show me where I'm wrong. That's all in what I'm about to say. And then I'll end with rire, rire, ho. Pai marire. So my best wishes to all of the New Zealanders out there. Thank you, Marie. I challenge you all, visit my website and show me where I'm wrong, and let's try and turn this around. Nō reira, me inoi, let's have our karakia. Tō tia kina māramatanga e te atua ki tō mātou kingi. Ki ngā tinana e mauiwi ana, taino ki a mātou katoa, i te rangi nei ai, nā au te glōria, nā au te glōria. Nā au te kōrea. Rire, rire, hau. Pai mari.
Kia ora, Lee. So if you have got anything you want to send to us or discuss or comment, inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email, 2057 is the text. Thank you to everybody, especially Rob, who sent us that big piece of feedback, because that's just it. I mean, we've got to be able to address it and talk about it and discuss it. And that, in a way, is, I think, a really good standard for us to look at is not to shy away from difficult conversations. Have a good kōrero and see what shakes out. So we will continue to do more of these conversations with Lee. I love chatting to you. And as he said, pātakarinstitute.com is where you will find his resources and website. So thank you very much, Lee. And we'll do it again soon. I know we will. And it's been great to talk to you again today. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. And I commend you on the show. It's a credit to our nation to have these.
Thank you so much. Kia ora, kia ora. So coming up next, of course, is Marty. We're going to be talking about what has transpired across the weekend, and I think the American debate could be coming up in our conversation. I know I definitely want to talk about it. So don't disappear, but the Media Matters is up here next on Counterculture with Reality Check Radio.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.